fractured unions in the world with the most members.
The world is vast, but it wasn't only Western Europe that had the strongest union power. But that wasn't all. The biggest organized social power, not political, because the term is ambiguous, was the CNT.
By late spring 1936, the National Confederation of Labor had about 1.5 million members throughout Spain, including half of all Catalonians.
With only one single paid bureaucrat, which is quite incredible if you think about it. One paid person in an organization that big.
In 1936, Macno had died and Durruti had returned to Spain. Elections took place. Anarchist groups, which presented no candidates, urged their members to vote for the Spanish Popular Front. And with millions of libertarian votes, the left wing won with a tiny minority and a government formed including socialists, Republican Democrats, and a handful of communists. The reaction from the right wing was swift. General Franco ordered all army regiments to take control of the country. Civil war had begun.
Franco's coup d'etat came about in 1936, and Spain burst open like a watermelon. On one side was the Progressive Front, and on the other, the Fascist Front. And for 3 years, it was a violent face-off.
Like in Italy and in Germany, the upper classes applauded the putsch. Captains of industry provided finance for the fascists, and the Democrats abdicated. The government of the Popular Front, rather than call for resistance, resigned 3 times in 1 day. The people were left to their own devices as half of the country fell under Franco's control. Libertarian groups launched an appeal for a general mobilization, and suddenly, in all spontaneity, as one, the anarchists answered the call. In Catalonia, led by Durruti, in charge of defending Barcelona, libertarians fended off right-wing forces. To the Barricades, the hymn of the CNT, written by Valeriano Orobon Fernandez, a leading anarcho-syndicalist theoretician, in just a few hours became the battle cry of half a nation. Columns formed. Durruti was appointed delegated commander of a militia made up of volunteer freedom fighters. The column, with 3,000 men and women divided into several centuries, named after significant martyrs such as Sacco and Vanzetti, the Durruti column, along with the red and black column, marched on Zaragoza, then converged one Aragon to confront the fascist armies. Inspired by the Macnovists, Durruti and his troops fought a war and led a revolution.
They forced fascism into a retreat, which later the Republican armies were unable to do. But that was notably in Aragon. And the moment that the Durruti columns liberated a village, they immediately proclaimed libertarian communism.
In cada pueblo aragonés,
in every liberated village, members of the Durruti column talked to the peasants. The anarchists told them to do away with the hedges separating the fields and to create vast collective zones and to work the land all together.
As they advanced, the libertarians chased out masters and gods and declared the end to all privileges. On the squares of liberated villages, lively new dances replaced the old laments. Couples formed in public. Land, work, and bread were shared. The elderly received retirement benefits, and people took time to enjoy life. New practices were invented, and solidarity was renewed. Anarchism deployed its thinking to the extreme. Farmers' assemblies, literacy campaigns. Over 800 Spanish towns and villages declared themselves communes. And one of the greatest collectivist experiments in history had begun.
There was an explosion of experiments. Whole towns, not just villages, did away with money. Great. But how would they live? So they invented something that wasn't in the writings of theoreticians. the so-called familial salary, where everybody worked together. But how do you share things? Based on individual effort? No, based on individual needs.
They abolished money. It seems unbelievable today, but thousands of people adhered to it and organized themselves around it. Naturally, on these liberated lands, the clergy was expropriated, and the former landowners found themselves working hand in hand with the peasants.
Things didn't go smoothly everywhere. The anarchists chased out the Guardia Civil and the fascists. But then Franco's troops reconquered the villages, and you can imagine the repression that came after.
People mention the churches burned down and the priests killed by the anarchists. It is true. It did happen. When power is seized by the people, it generates acts like that. Revolutionary anarchist Mikhail Bakunin himself said, "When revolution comes, it's inevitable that 100 heads will roll. 100 heads isn't a lot compared to the horrors committed by the fascists."
With almost unlimited material sent by Henry Ford and the support of Italian troops and the infamous German Konterlegion, Franco and his followers launched a campaign of social and ideological cleansing. Like in Seville, where 8,000 people were bayoneted to death, or at Guernica, where men, women, and children were indiscriminately slaughtered by Luftwaffe bombs. Despite widespread fears, the request for arms made by the libertarians to Western democracies went unanswered. The anarchists could, however, count on the international solidarity of the movement, which, in newspapers and conferences, appealed for supporters to join the ranks of the insurgents. The Frenchman Sébastien Faure, anarchist burglar Maurice Jacob, the Algerian Mohamed Say, the Argentinian Diego Abad de Santillan, the Belgian Louis Mercier Vega, the Russian Georges Sosenko, and political activist Simone Veil, who enrolled in the Durruti column, like Emma Goldman, who at 67 years old, fought in Catalonia. From all around the world, men and women arrived in Spain to support the revolution, and with the first international brigades, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, made up of mostly IWW members, the Malatesta Battalion, nicknamed the Battalion of Death, and the Louise Michel Battalion from France, foreign revolutionaries, as they arrived, suddenly brought about a change.
In their countries of origins, whether they were French, British, American, or Italians or Germans who were in Franco's camps, at no time had they ever encountered an anarchist movement on such a huge scale. George Orwell wrote a wonderful account. In Britain, he frequented not a communist milieu, but a Trotskyite milieu, and he came to Spain to fight. When he arrived in Barcelona, it was a big discovery for him. In Britain, he had no idea that the anarchists existed and even held the city. His account has a slightly odd title, Homage to Catalonia.
In theory, it was perfect equality, and even in practice, it was not far from it. There is a sense in which it would be true to say that one was experiencing a foretaste of socialism, by which I mean that the prevailing mental atmosphere was that of socialism. Many of the normal motives of civilized life had simply ceased to exist. The ordinary class division of society had almost disappeared. There was no one there except the peasants and ourselves, and no one owned anyone else as his master.
As the international brigades left to reinforce the anarchist columns on the front, to the rear, now aware of the key role the propaganda could play, the libertarians took over the film industry, and with the little money they had, shot newsreels of the fierce battles they were fighting in Aragon. But in this war of images, in which for the first time it was they who were doing the filming, the anarchists made sure to report on the scale and specifics of their revolution as CNT cameramen captured live footage of an insurgent capital.
The first report on events in Barcelona was made by the CNT, the Union of Public Spectacle. They went out onto the streets to film what was happening at the barricades. We have some marvelous footage of a city in revolution. We don't have any of St. Petersburg or other places. But here we have footage that tells what a city in revolution is like.
These images show a city that is practically anarchist, with an incredible popular enthusiasm that has never been reproduced in our history.
These newsreels revealed to the world the scale and coherency of the Spanish Libertarian Revolution. Amidst the remains of the barricades and the destroyed centers of power, documentary makers such as Felix Marquet captured each step in this great upheaval. Here, anarcho-syndicalism was working at full steam. All forms of bureaucracy, non-productive jobs, and the role of foreman were abolished. Major decisions were taken in councils, work was carried out in common, and production means recuperated by the collectivity. In Catalonia, far from the industrial heart of Spain, over 75% of companies were self-managed. Tramways, taxis and buses, hotels and restaurants, bakeries, fishing, foodstuffs, textiles, the leather and shoemaking industry. All these small businesses, like large companies, were now managed collectively with no fall in efficiency or production. The revolution even made inroads into culture, which suddenly became popular and social once more. Movies, classical music, opera, and cabaret were managed directly by the actors, dancers, musicians, technicians, and ushers, who were all members of the CNT. Emma Goldwyn, who was 67 when she arrived in Catalonia to support the revolution, wrote,
"The collectivization of the industries and the land stand out as the greatest achievement of any revolutionary period. Your revolution will destroy forever the idea that the anarchist project means chaos. Moreover, if Franco should win and the Spanish anarchists be exterminated, the work they have started will continue to live."
It means that anarchism can work, but on what condition? On the condition that the majority of people believe in libertarian principles. So it's possible to found a society without authority and without government, or with a minimum of authority and a minimum of government.
The triumph of anarchism in Spain found a last but paradoxical expression on November 4, 1936, when the Republicans decided to form in Madrid a new government of victory, so as to rally the different anti-fascist groups against the Franco forces. For the first time in history, four libertarians became ministers.
On the one hand, their presence was in order to reinforce the government, but it was also a way for the anarchist militia to obtain arms. So it was give and take.
But they were ministers with no real importance. They entered government with a strategic aim. They did it to have some control over the government, to prevent the government carrying out anti-anarchist acts.
In practice, the anarchist militia didn't really obtain more arms, and in the eyes of the combatants, this entry into government was at the worst a betrayal and at the best a mistake. So a split formed between the grassroots anarchists and the four ministers.
The anarchist movement began to break up. The Communist Party, also with representatives in the government, began to play a more preponderant role thanks to the military backing provided by Stalin, and they were intent on taking advantage of the split. The communists demanded that the libertarian revolution be adjourned and the anarchist militia disarmed, then drafted into a regular army under the command of political commissioners sent specially by the Soviet Union. The government and the four anarchist ministers voted for the proposal. Durruti saw it as a betrayal. He spoke out.
"If you don't want those who are fighting to mistake you, you in the rear ground, for our enemies, then do your duty. The war we're currently fighting is being fought to crush the enemy at the front. But is it our only enemy? No. The enemy are also those who oppose revolutionary conquests, those who are amongst us, those we will also crush."
In the eyes of the Stalinists and the Republicans, Durruti and his column, which held Aragon, had become too strong, too dangerous, and too radical. It was urgent to seize back control.
The moment he wanted to change things too radically, the reformists turned against him. The Stalinists, who wanted to found a society with a strict hierarchy, turned against him. And obviously, the bourgeoisie was against him. And it was at that moment that the Republicans were caught in a dilemma. And many of them began saying, "We prefer fascist order to anarchy."
To weaken the anarchists and to have Durruti in their control, the government decided to order his column to Madrid, which was under siege from Franco's forces. The libertarians smelled a trap, but Durruti hoped to use the occasion to relaunch the revolutionary process in the Spanish capital. His death, which came about in mysterious circumstances, gave rise to the most outlandish of rumors.
He was in a car, and he wanted to check out the situation. So he got out, and when he came back to the car, he died. More precisely, he was shot. One of the first interpretations was it was an assassination. A shot like that from close range can only be an assassination. And this rumor was immediately spread by Franco's camp in order to say that the Republicans had started killing each other. This theory was then taken up by the communists, who said that the anarchists were just a disorganized bunch of petit bourgeois who were killing each other. But I think it was an accident. In the car was a soldier holding a rifle. On a lot of rifles back then, the safety catch didn't work very well. And as Durruti got in, he took a bullet. During the Civil War, saying that a figure like Durruti had died in a stupid accident caused by a misfiring gun would have sounded ridiculous.
Still today, the circumstances of Durruti's death remain unclear. His body was transported across the country to Barcelona. A cortege of over 500,000 people made its way to the Montjuïc Cemetery, where he was buried. It was the last large-scale public show of force made by the anarchists during the Spanish Civil War.
Durruti was an icon. And without Durruti, anarchism had lost its figurehead.
Anarchism is a political theory which advocates the destruction of power. It's not a strategy for political conquest. Communism, on the other hand, is. And the communists, who numbered only 10,000 compared to millions and millions of anarchists, managed in under a year, with the backing of the Soviet Union, to take control of things.
And that's when the Great Repression started, which would culminate in the events of May 1937 and the violent clashes in which the libertarian revolution was crushed.
It was during what anarchist historians call the May Days of 37, part of which is featured in the movie Land and Freedom by Ken Loach, that the revolution was crushed. It began with the Battle of Telefónica. Since the beginning of the revolution, the anarchists had controlled Barcelona's telephone central. The Republicans, allied with the Stalinists, were determined to oust them. The fuse was lit. The people of Barcelona raised barricades. Despite calls for calm from the anarchist ministers, they faced off like at Kronstadt 15 years earlier, only this time alongside the Trotskyists of the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, practically unarmed against 3,000 fully equipped and highly trained assault guards.
Y eso provoca una semana.
The clashes lasted all week. Remember that Franco's putsch in Barcelona had been put down in 2 days. But the fighting here, between the base and the government, lasted 7 days, with over 1,000 dead and hundreds wounded.
After the defeat of the anarchists during the May Days of 37 and the ensuing repression, the gates of Barcelona were open to the fascists. The Republican and Stalinist government could now step up counter-revolutionary measures in the small territory still under its control. On May 25th, the Anarchist Federation was excluded from the People's Court. On June 6th, a governmental decree made all rural collectives illegal. In early August, the Regional Council for the Defense of Aragon was definitively disbanded. At the end of August, criticism of the Soviet Union was officially banned. On January 6, 1938, the government prohibited by decree the issuing of money by the committees. And later in 1938, the government annulled all that remained of the collectives and reinstated all rights to wealthy landowners. the Spanish Libertarian Revolution had been quashed, and in Moscow, Pravda declared in its editorial, "The cleansing of anarchists has been completed with the same gusto as in the Soviet Union."
The Spanish Civil War ended on April 1, 1939. Many anarchists were interred in concentration camps, but many of them also faced the firing squad.
It's unbelievable when you compare the number of CNT and Anarchist Federation members just before the Spanish Social Revolution with the number that remained just after the fascist victory. People might think this was the result of fascist repression, but in fact, it was mainly repression by the Republican government in line with the wishes of the Stalinists, and all historians confirm this. The Spanish Civil War was a deeply traumatic episode in 20th century history, even if it's not an episode that immediately comes to mind when you examine 20th century history. I see it as a huge turning point. It was a bloody and truly horrible event in 20th century history. The abandonment by European democracies, the Italian fascists, the Nazis, Stalinist Soviet Union, the whole of Europe ganged up to ensure the experiment failed, and fail it did.
As they crossed the Pyrenees amongst the thousands of refugees heading into exile, those who had survived the war continued to ask themselves why they had lost and where and when they could resume the fight.
The situation of the anarchists after the First World War was extremely difficult. But after the failure of the Spanish Revolution, it was catastrophic. What option did they have left to them? To join up with the Bolsheviks? To convert to fascism? If they wanted to keep up the fight, what could they do? Join the French army to fight the Nazis? What else could they do to save their skins?
In April 1939, World War II was yet to break out. But on seeing the concentration camps in which France greeted the survivors of the revolution, how could Spanish anarchists not feel dismayed? Especially when French Prime Minister Édouard Daladier, who had already reimposed the 48-hour working week and signed the Munich Accords, decided to appoint as the first ambassador to Franco, Philippe Pétain, the most noble and most human of our military leaders, according to Léon Blum at the time. But the situation was even more difficult for them, as it was for all anarchists across the globe, because the counter-revolution was triumphing everywhere. In fascist countries, of course, but also in socialist republics and liberal democracies, reactionaries added to their list of victims, like during the Memorial Day massacre in 1937 in the United States, when the Chicago Police Department shot and killed a dozen workers, including a woman and three children, and wounded many others. And as usual, in a world gradually being covered with barbed wire, the libertarians were the first targets of repression. From Le Veronais to Orianenburg, they were rounded up, deported, and some, like Eric Musum, executed. For in this context of a global capitalist crisis, the crushing of revolutionaries constituted to the bourgeoisie the necessary preliminary for its desire to expand. And imperialism, as we know it in the past and in the present, while constantly uttering the word peace, had long been preparing for war. Spain, along with Abyssinia and Manchuria, was much more than a dress rehearsal for war. In reality, all the non-aggression pacts that were signed merely accelerated the process which was already underway. And the sole aim in exacerbating nationalist sentiments was to prevent workers from uniting. So it was imperative to wipe from all memory all those men and women who had abolished the state, currency, and frontiers, and had tried with all their might and against all odds to build a better world. And it was thus, in the dark days of a new world war, which would unleash the most barbaric of passions and turn the planet into a field of ruins, as workers were drafted into regiments, fanaticized, reduced into slavery or to ashes, that the last words of Viruti could be heard as an echo.
We've always lived in poverty, and we can continue to do so for some time. But don't forget that we, the workers, are the only generators of wealth. We operate the machines. We extract coal from the mines. We build the towns and cities. And we know that we will only deserve ruins because the bourgeoisie will try to destroy the world in the last instance of its history. But we have no fear of ruins because we carry a new world in our hearts.
Car notre sang bleu est noir. Notre drapeau rouge est noir. Notre étoile jaune est noire. Notre vie en rose est noire. Oui, notre sang bleu est noir. Notre drapeau rouge est noir. Notre étoile jaune est noire. Notre vie en rose est noire. Oui, notre sang bleu.
Part of me, 'cause wherever die and stop it all.
You're listening.